Hello and welcome to the first Formulated By podcast live from Data Science Salon New York, where we gather 200 plus data practitioners to hear the latest in AI and ML's impact in the media. I'm Danielle Oberdier, Content and Community Manager at Formulated By, and I will let our guest host, Q, take it away.
Good morning, everyone. We are here for the Data Science Salon New York. I am Q McCallum, Senior Content Advisor here at Formulated By, the company that's putting on Data Science Salon, and I'm here today with...
Hi, I'm Lauren Lombardo. I am a Senior Data Scientist at Nielsen, and today at the Data Science Salon, I'm talking about organizational effectiveness and how to build data science teams to deliver data science that works for the media and entertainment industry.
And...
Sergi Fogelson, I'm the VP of Data Science and Modeling at Viacom, and I'm speaking about Viacom's cross-platform measurement solution and how unifying our audiences will allow us to deliver an even better Viacom experience.
Excellent. Thank you both for being here. And given the descriptions of your talks, I think the audience will now see why we brought you here today to talk about our topic, which is the effectiveness of data. So we live in this world where it seems everyone is using data science and machine learning and AI to drive decisions and build predictive models and all of that, but there's always this question in the back of everyone's mind, which is, we have built this model, or we have done this analysis. How can we demonstrate how effective it is?
Sure. So I'll start with the Nielsen perspective in terms of media measurement. So from a ratings perspective, our Nielsen products help brands decide if their ad has been effective by helping them understand who that ad has reached after it has been aired on TV or posted online. And our content ratings platforms often act as a planning tool to help brands understand what the audiences on those platforms might be. So really at Nielsen, we are able to see the beginning portion of an ad campaign, helping our clients understand where the audiences they're trying to reach might be, what platforms and brands they visit the most often. And we get to help advertising clients towards the end of that campaign understand the effectiveness of their ad by realizing who they did reach. I think that data is really important in that planning cycle for advertising clients and really helps them make the best decisions and spend their dollars wisely.
So at Viacom, as a publisher, what we try to do or how we use data to inform our strategies to entice brands to advertise with us is we show how our core audiences display high affinities with the specific advertisers that we are interested in. So, for example, it might be the case that we can show that BET's core audience has a very high affinity with Coca-Cola, or let's say Home Depot has a very high affinity with CMT's core audience. The point being that we can use data, both our own first-party data and other third-party data that we license, to be able to understand how those affinities play out in real time, how they've played out historically, and to make compelling stories about how they can play out in the future.
Okay. That makes sense to me, and that actually dovetails well into our next question here. So let's talk about how we can actually assess the effectiveness, in other words, measure the effectiveness of some of this content. How do you do that? We'll start with you, Sergi.
So the way that we can assess it really is from two different perspectives. So the first is just from like a reach perspective. So how many unique people or what segment of the population did the specific ad campaign actually reach? So that's basically more of like an awareness campaign. The other kind of effectiveness, this is much harder to do. This is where you can actually attribute an exposure of a specific ad to a specific conversion event. So for example, Let's say you are a quick serve restaurant. Let's say you're McDonald's. You run a campaign with a whole host of different linear media advertiser, linear media companies. So, you know, with us at Viacom, with Turner, with some other larger media networks, and you're trying to understand which of those brands drove the most foot traffic to your stores. That's a much harder question to tackle. There are now third-party data providers that can help us get to answering that question. So, for example, a given person was exposed to an ad on this network this many times, this other network this many times, and then they actually went and visited McDonald's a week after the fact. And we can actually see that that happened. And you can basically credit that, you can attempt to credit that exposure to that specific conversion event that happened. We've just begun to start doing some work around that at Viacom, but it's still very, very early days just because that data is very, very hard to come by.
Okay. And what makes that data so hard to come by, though?
So the reason is because, there's really a couple reasons. One is because that relies on information that is gathered from people's mobile use and mobile behaviors. So there are various third-party data providers that exist that basically capture this information, but people have to actually opt in, right? So they have to, you have to give people the right to say, yes, I want to be tracked in this way, such that you can give, you know, something back to that user. So you can imagine there are apps that will give you good location information on where it is that you're trying to go, or you're trying to find points of interest within a specific city. But while that app is running, it's also capturing your presence somewhere, right? Somewhere out in the physical world. That information is then sent back to that app provider, and then either they use it for some purposes or they don't. And that information, the sizes of the basically the number of unique devices that exist in those kinds of data products are still fairly small, and they have it's very, very hard to then be able to actually match those back to people within their own households, right? So, for example, they might see a commercial for McDonald's on linear television, and you know that a specific device belongs to that specific household where they watch the ad, but you're not you don't actually know, for example, although you know that that device then appeared at McDonald's, you don't actually know that they actually saw that specific ad, I guess, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it totally does. All right. So that's very interesting perspective coming from the world of Viacom. I mean, Lauren, what about you? You work at Nielsen. Do you see things differently from your perspective?
Yeah, so I certainly think there are a lot of really interesting things that we can do to understand the effectiveness of ads, but I would agree that data availability is an incredibly challenging problem. So although we have a lot of interesting methods to try to understand and to create a product suite at Nielsen that we call our resonance or reaction products, those often tend to be more customized solutions just because of the challenges that come with getting this type of behavioral insight into how people are absorbing the ads that they consume. So certainly at Nielsen, we do a lot to look at this data. We're a data company, and we're always trying to find new and interesting ways to bring different insights to the marketplace. So we'll, you know, do focus groups to try to understand how people are interacting with certain sites and if there are certain parts of a site that draw their attention more than others. That'll include, you know, really cutting-edge behavioral science techniques and a whole host of other interesting insights that you can get out of focus groups using EEG headsets and answering different questions and that whole realm of behavioral science stuff. We also have Sergey was talking through some online data that you can get from people that have seen the advertisement. We do try to do some prompting on digital devices to see if people remember certain information from ads that they had seen previously, to understand if they are retaining that information. That's sort of the resonance component, right? And so when we're thinking through these things at Nielsen, there are a lot of different solutions that we can try to take to understand the marketplace, but I would agree that the data availability, especially the amount of data that we would want to fully understand, is rare. What we do at Nielsen is we break it out into, like I said, the resonance and reaction suite. So resonance, really what we're looking at there is to see, do people remember what's going on with the advertisement? Can they recall what they saw? Was it at least effective enough to be something that is memorable to those who consumed it within varying amounts of time periods, anywhere from 5 minutes to several hours? And then the reaction component, we try to, we can do some sort of combinations with Nielsen Connect data, which is where we, do the same type of measurement, but on the buy side, we help understand what people are buying in retail stores and from CPG clients and online. So we do have this whole host of purchasing data that we can combine with media data to try to understand if there was a reaction. If, not only did someone understand and remember what happened in the ad, but did they go out and take the action that advertiser wanted? And really, I think those are the two important pieces of understanding ad effectiveness. You clearly need resonance to get the reaction component, but unless you are just trying to move forward with some type of brand awareness campaign, which many advertisers do, most advertisers are also looking for the reaction component, so we try to focus on that as well to provide that insight to our clients.
Yeah, I dig that, and it sounds like a great way to close that gap between exposure and actual conversion. Because when it comes to any sort of advertising, that's why it's been the ultimate question, right? How do we actually prove that, yes, you displayed this ad, the person made this purchase, do we really know it's because of the ad or something else?
Yeah.
Yeah, but Lauren, you made a good point just a minute ago about data, and I know we've been hearing this for years that, the more data we have, the better decisions we'll make and all that. And you mentioned that you would love to get more data to drive these decisions. Where would you like to get more of that data from?
Well, I think it depends, right, on what type of data that we're getting and what we're using it for. Certainly, more data, from a data science perspective, more data would be helpful to build better methodologies, more comprehensive and powerful models, and to provide better insights for our clients. But I am very well aware of, who it is that is providing this data to us, and the need to be mindful of what we're getting and how much we need in order to build the models that we are working to provide to the industry. So I guess this is kind of a roundabout way of saying, a lot of Nielsen's data relies on panels. These are people that Nielsen has recruited to, voluntarily enlist to share their information because they care about adequate representation for their, the demo group that they represent in the population, and they want to ensure that voice is heard when it comes to things like content and advertising ratings, to ensure that those that are creating the content are aware that they are there and that they are an audience that content can and should be created for, and that advertisements can and should be sold to, right? So if we're talking about panel data, I certainly think that's some of the most powerful panel data Nielsen has, and we can continue to grow that panel data and to ensure that people continue to feel comfortable to sign up and voluntarily give us the information on what types of content they're consuming so that we can help our clients make better decisions. When it comes to, big data, air quotes, around big data and those larger third-party sets that a lot of people in the industry are working in, I think those certainly have their place. But we need to be really careful about privacy there. So when we're thinking about something like ad effectiveness, that needs to be probably really personal data, because we need to track that to actual purchase decisions. So we need to be able to understand who saw that ad and what they did with it. I think that data really should come from our panels. I think people should be aware that they are giving us that information, and we can work in partnership with them to provide that insight to the industry. And that data can be supplemented by third-party data sets and big data to help us get the sample size necessary to make some of the models work. But I think there's definitely a balance there with where we're getting data to build these models for the industry.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And that what I appreciate is something both of you have touched on. Even though you haven't used the word ethics directly, you're talking a lot about the ethical use, the ethical collection of data. This notion of people who, as Sergey mentioned, who have opted in to being tracked, and something, Lauren, you mentioned about people who volunteer to sign up for these panels. I mean, there is that open question, which is, do we think data that comes from willing participants is ultimately better in tracking this notion of exposure attribution to a purchase? What do you two think?
I mean, I'm fairly well aware of the challenges around privacy and the importance of having willing participants in whatever measurement it is that you are doing. I think obviously that is there's a self-selection bias there, right, where you're maybe the larger population actually has a completely different perspective on your product than the people that are willing to be tracked, right? Maybe they want to say, hey, they're actually your boosters, or they're your super fans, or whatever it is. I mean, I think basically that they're the way that in a perfect world that it would work is that people read the terms of service of every product that they use, that they have the option to actually select and decline certain components of those terms of service, as opposed to just being able to say either take all of this or goodbye, we don't want you. I mean, I think that's really important. And then the other thing is there needs to be transparency in what exactly is known about said entity, whatever that entity is. I mean, the problem is on the internet, everything is just a device. This notion of like there's a person behind that device is very problematic, because we know that there's four devices or multiple devices per person. The same device can actually have multiple identifiers. There's just a whole host of problems there. I think what you do is you basically choose the levels of granularity that you want to expose people to in terms of the information you have on them. So what I mean by that is, let's say that I am Sergey. I'm on my VH1 app. There's a little link somewhere on the app that says, hey, you've opted into using this app and you've opted into the collection of your data. Are you interested in knowing what it is that we know about you? And then you can click that link, and it basically lists over some time horizon every possible way that you've interacted with our apps, what it is that we keep about you. So we don't say, hey, you keep watching, you know, Love & Hip Hop at midnight for 7 minutes and then you leave. You provide something like, hey, you know, you've watched 6 hours of Love & Hip Hop over the past 6 months. Oh, and by the way, because you've opted into X, Y, Z, and A, B, and C, we also know that you've been to McDonald's twice in the past 6 months or whatever it is. And we wouldn't know, for example, that it's the McDonald's that's a block away from your house, but that it's a McDonald's, one McDonald's within the New York City DMA, for example, which there could be, I don't even know how many McDonald's there are in New York, but there's probably in the New York DMA, because the DMA is massive, probably like thousands, right? So there is this kind of give and take between having useful information, but having it at a obfuscated enough level where you're literally not spookily tracking everything about that person, and then you're actually honestly using that specifically aggregated level of information for building your model, saying like, hey, you know, this person watched more than 2 hours of this specific piece of content, and they visited this specific quick serve restaurant chain or this specific home improvement store or whatever, whatever other business. But I mean, I think ultimately, really, it's two things. It's being very, very clear and being selective in how you can apply terms of service, which is literally not how the internet works at all, but I think it should totally move that way. And then being very, very clear about allowing customers or consumers to see exactly what it is that you store about them, that you use about them to make whatever decisions it is that you make about them. I don't know if we'll get to that anytime soon. I mean, I think there are now policies in place, or they will be coming online within the next couple of years in California. There are obviously laws in Europe that allow a measure of this kind of data availability and this notion of being able to understand exactly what it is that companies capture about you. And hopefully we get to something like that dream world in the future.
I think that's an interesting point. I'm going to go back first to the comment on bias of a sample of volunteer panelists, essentially. So, yes, that's certainly true normally for convenience panels. For probabilistically sampled panels, we can do a pretty good job at ensuring that no matter the cost, we'll find people that are representative of the U.S. population or whichever market that we're in. But those panels are really expensive to recruit, right? Like the Nielsen TV panel is probabilistically sampled. It is a representative sample of the United States population. But for the most part, other panels are convenience-based panels, and they do have the bias. So that's where I think big data comes in. And I think the points about how do we anonymize that big data enough so that we are comfortable using it? It's much easier to anonymize that big data or completely abstract it away from the sample that it came from when you do have a panel or another sample of data that does have the demographics and information that you need that can act as your universe. Essentially, in the big data can act as supplemental material. So that's what I find interesting about Nielsen. For example, we recently changed up the way that we did local TV measurement. We still have Nielsen panels, but now we utilize big data to fill in some of the gaps that were left when we just relied on the panel. We're able to abstract completely that big data away from any personalized information and have it be completely untraceable. It's essentially just like a big aggregate blob of information from the entire world, untraceable to any particular human, and are able to use that to identify similar behaviors to the behaviors of our panelists and append demographics by linking behavioral data in a way that helps us grow our sample of panelists while utilizing big data in a really private and secure way, while we rely on those who have opted in and take only what we need from big data samples to try to ensure privacy in that way. I also think that it's really interesting to think about, you know, data privacy in terms of what we're getting from our users and what we're getting from those who utilize digital services. But it's also interesting to think about data privacy and ethics from, you know, a post-data science modeling perspective. So as we're leveraging this data, you know, at Nielsen we have this saying when it comes to using data that can be considered private is never take more than you need. Now, if you don't need certain columns or variables to do your analysis, don't take that data. Like, try throughout the entire process of building a methodology to keep the users in mind and to be as secure as possible with the data that you're leveraging. And it's important to think through user privacy at every step of the data science you know, platform of getting these tools and methodologies to market, not just at the point where we intake data, either from panels or from websites or third-party data providers.
Awesome. And something you mentioned a second ago, this notion of only taking the data you need, only pulling the columns you need. Do you ever hear the term Datensparsamkeit thrown around your office?
Can't say that I have, no.
Okay, no worries. No, I ask because it's someone explained this to me a while ago. It's a term from German privacy practices. It roughly translates to data sparingness, but it's exactly what you're talking about, which is a lot of companies, and I'm sure we've all seen them, a lot of companies, they just figure, well, we keep hearing that data is the new gold or the new oil or the new whatever rich element is out there. And they figure, well, just the more we have, the better off we're going to be. And there's this notion of yes and no, right? Because the more data you've brought in, the more data you have at risk. If there's a leak, if someone heads down a road that's maybe still legal but slightly immoral, that sort of thing. So this notion of just being very sparing in your use of data and having it very focused on the specifics of what you want to do is very helpful.
And the more noise you have, right? Like, there's this thought in the industry 5 or 6 years ago when big data was starting to be thrown around that was going to solve everything, and that just because there was more data, that is going to be, you know, more useful and provide us better solutions. Well, yeah, certainly big data can help do things such as stabilize models because it, you know, can reduce fluctuations that we see in smaller samples or to, you know, reduce standard error in our samples. So certainly having more data helps with the statistical analysis of things, but it's not always better. And there's a lot of trade-offs that come with just collecting everything that you possibly can. It's noisy. It's, you know, not always able to be linked towards specific results so that we can see in our panel data where we can actually track over time and individually what is happening, whereas in big data, it can provide, you know, obviously more information to look at, but less direction.
And when it comes to the internet, I want to interject here. Like, there is so much bot activity online.
Yeah.
There is just an unholy amount of computers pretending to be people. I mean, the latest, I think the latest stats on this are something like roughly half of all web traffic online now is being performed by bots. Okay, so it just because you have a million hits on your website, or just because you have 10 million Twitter followers, doesn't actually mean that those were a million authentic individuals or 10 million authentic people that are actually following you and responding with you. I mean, that's there are plenty of ways that you can attack traditional panel-based methods because, as Lauren had mentioned about like small sample size and all that stuff. At the end of the day, when it comes to Nielsen's TV panel, can't attack the fact that it's definitely all people. Like, those are every single one of those PIDs that you see in the TV panel. It's definitely a person. And so that's something that if anything, you can use that as kind of like your golden source of truth. If your larger scale data reflects trends smoother versions of trends that you see in the panel-based, actual people-based data, then that's good. That means that you're going somewhere in the right direction. If, however, you're seeing something that diverges from what you like online, for example, all of a sudden you're seeing that some random no-name WordPress blog is the most actively visited website online, and it's not Google or Facebook or Wikipedia or what have you, then you really need to investigate what in the world is happening there. I mean, you know, extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. And so this kind of this interplay of larger scale log data that comes from wherever, working alongside the smaller scale kind of like golden data that you know is actually driven by actual willing participants, I think is really, really important. And that's why I think that although these larger scale data measurement solutions are definitely going to keep coming online, ultimately they're going to they're really going to prove their value, and people are going to trust them a lot more when they reflect, at least broadly, the stuff that you're seeing in these verified, probabilistic, stratified, sampled approaches like what Nielsen's using.
Exactly. And this, it's funny, Sergi, you mentioned something I was going to touch on as well that Lauren just mentioned. A few moments ago, she said that panels, on the one hand, they're extremely effective. On the other hand, they're very expensive to run, which makes perfect sense. I mean, bringing a bunch of people together, verifying this and that, tracking all the data, it can take lots of time, energy, money. On the flip side, there's a lot to be said for the quality of that data. In other words, knowing where that data actually came from, was, to your point, Sergi, was it actually based on real people's decisions, plays a lot into the effectiveness of that data. And that's also first-party data. You've collected it yourself. You know what went into it. Compare that to people who buy lists, lots of third-party data, and they don't sort of mix it in with their first-party data. They just try to go off of that whole hog. And the results, as we've seen time and time again, just aren't as effective as I think some advertisers would like. Anyone who has downloaded their data from Twitter or other social media platforms to see which advertisers are trying to reach them, they'll realize these are way off. Favorite example, I think this was just yesterday, someone tweeted that she finally downloaded all of her Facebook data and found out that about 90% of the advertisers trying to reach her were looking for someone trying to buy a car. And she said, I don't own a car, have never owned a car, not trying to own one.
I live in New York City. I take the subway.
Yeah.
So you look at that and you have to wonder, is that just the cost of using third-party data whole hog without taking the time, effort, and energy to build your first-party data?
Yeah, I certainly think it is. You touched on an interesting point. I know that probably wasn't the point you meant to touch on, but the specific example of trying to own a car, you know, as well. I understand why the industry wants to move in a direction of really granular advertising.
Sure.
and trying to really directly target people that are in New York City and are exactly 25 years old and have a cat and two roommates and live on the Upper West Side. But, like, that is impossible to track. I shouldn't say impossible. I certainly think that, you know, we can try to find samples of those people, but you run into those sample size issues, whether those people come from a panel that you know is representative and that you trust, or it comes from a third-party data set or big data. That's a really hard subset to try to sell that level of advertising on, and it gets back to our privacy issues. If that's really what you're trying to do, then what type of data do you need to make that happen? That's a really concerning amount of detail to make those types of ads effective. So I wonder if we've gotten to a place in advertising where we're trying to be so specific and either aren't willing to cross certain privacy lines, which I think is a good thing that we haven't crossed those, or are unable to find that level of data and need to have a conversation about where we really want to be as an industry and where we really want this type of advertising to go. Do we want to be that granular? Do we have the data to support that? Or are we okay making these wild assumptions about large groups of people and trying to put them into these really specific buckets? I think we've certainly seen Facebook run into a lot of problems trying to segment people into smaller and smaller and smaller groups for advertisers. And I'm not entirely sure, unless you have a product that only works for that type of person, which I can't imagine which product is successful enough to advertise and only works for 25-year-olds with a cat and three roommates on the Upper West Side. Otherwise, I don't really understand why we need to get that segmented for the advertising.
Well, there's also this notion of not just getting to that level of granularity and how effective it is. There's also the notion of value, in other words, being cost-effective. How much data are you willing to collect, store, and analyze? How many data scientists are you willing to throw at a particular problem to find, like you said, the person who has two roommates and doesn't drive a car and has a cat, lives on the Upper West Side? What is the actual value of finding that person, and how many ads can you sell to recoup your investment?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think the notion of creating or measuring, approximating the value of a very specific, super targeted micro segment definitely poses its own challenges, and I don't really know that that's really what you want to do, right? I think as an advertiser or as a company that wants to sell stuff to the people that want your stuff. You want to ultimately target all of the people, regardless of whether they have roommates or not, whether they have animal pets or not, where they live. None of that should really matter. Ultimately, it's about matching consumer needs with the things that people produce. And I think this is where, instead of this idea of like, oh, well, we used to do age gender demos. Now we do age gender interest demos. Now we're going to do age gender interest sub-interest demos. Now we're going to do, you know, your astrological sign intermixed. I mean, I think that kind of idea is... The sample size is going to be one for every possible subsegment, because there's really only one person that's interested in that specific thing. I think what you had meant, kind of to bring this back to what you talked about earlier about data I wish we had. Yes. I think ultimately it's a combination of two things. There are state based properties of people. Like, for example, for most of your life, for most people, you are of this specific gender and you have this specific collection of propensities about yourself. You care about the way that you look. You care about, what part of the country you want to live in. There are specific... I mean, this is getting super high level, and I apologize for kind of talking about this, but the point I'm trying to make is the following. If you can get psychographic information about people, both their states, their traits, meaning like psychographic information that persists throughout their lives as people, as well as state-based information. So like how they are feeling right now, okay? That's really the kind of targeting that you really want to be able to do. So for example, car buying is basically like a trait that persists for some amount of time, for let's say 6 months every 10 years for people. Okay, versus unless you're very wealthy and you love buying cars, you're Jay Leno, you have 300 cars and you buy a car every 6 months. But then there are basically state-based things that are happening for people. So for example, I might be angry right now, and so I would be in market for a Elizabeth Warren campaign, okay? I want to be able to, to give her some money because I'm really angry about what's happening. Or maybe I'm really, really hungry, and so at this moment in time, I definitely could be served a burger ad and I'd have a much higher propensity to convert. That kind of data is completely unavailable, and that's because right now we treat all consumer information as trait-based, as if it persists throughout the life cycle of seeing that person in your platform, in your first-party data, in your third-party logs, whatever it is. Like, for example, the car buying example that you gave, where literally a person's going to be a car buyer forever on Facebook, and so you're going to just keep delivering them, you know, Dodge Ram ads, even when they already bought their Kia or whatever it is 8 years ago, you know what I'm saying? And like, they're still car buyers. So I think this idea of having people, of being able to separate how we segment people, and also really starting to think about larger scale psychographic, like propensities of people, is really where you're going to be able to kind of escape this, oh, I'm going to subsegment every single individual into this super, super specific thing, and then I'm going to try to target on some granularity level of that super, super specific thing. I think it has to be a lot more almost like reactive advertising, where you get some signal at a given point in time, you figure out something about what the state of that entity is, and then you deliver that ad that you think is maximally effective for the specific state that the person is in currently, and then you intermix it with every once in a while trait-based ads. So like, I know you really like to spend, you're a luxury purse buyer, so every few weeks I'm just going to hit you with a new luxury purse ad.
That's totally cool. That's why we're here. So, and it's interesting. We've been talking a lot about the challenges that you face working in a digital space, right? Everything is online. Devices are online. Tracking is left, right, and center. I mean, let's talk a little bit about, I guess we can call it old school media. Things such as, when I say print, I mean actual printed magazines and newspapers, that sort of thing, not the print that's become online. So let's say we're talking about print, we're talking about out of home, we're talking about television. I mean, what are some ways we can make those media more compatible with the modern day digital advertising we have right now?
Yeah, so I think we're seeing the data in the media and entertainment industry move those more traditional forms of media consumption closer and closer to the ways that people consume, digital first consumption, right? And that's really interesting because soon all that's going to separate somebody watching TV from someone watching a piece of content on their desktop is literally the size of the screen. And from a data science perspective, that has a lot of interesting questions that come along with it. So how do people's behavior watching patterns change as their platform changes? You know, does someone watching something on their laptop or on their smartphone change the way that they are watching something versus when they're watching it on the TV glass? Yes, I would assume that it does, that people are much more likely to multitask, to walk away, to be doing other things if it's if they're watching content on this big screen in their room that they can sort of see from a lot of different angles. I would say that they're probably much less likely to do any of those things if they're holding up their smartphone and watching something on their smartphone or watching something on their tablet, and they're probably much more likely to pause that device and to put it down. So I think when we talk about traditional media, specifically traditional TV, we're starting to see ways where that media form of media is coming a lot closer to newer forms of media, to traditional digital media, but also ways where it's staying very separate. So we have addressable ads, you know, possible on TV now, where ads can be served in the exact same way that they can be served on digital devices. They can target and segment how we were talking about earlier based on data that they know about who's in the household and even data about who they assume is watching from the list of people that are in that household to make sure that advertisements change based on who is most likely to be in front of the TV screen. That is getting closer and closer to the way that ads are served on digital platforms. You can also watch over the top on TV, you know, and that's something that's long been considered a type of digital media, but you're observing that content over the TV glass. You have smart TVs where you can see, you know, you can watch through apps. That's another way where digital and TV are coming together, where traditional and new media are colliding, yet they stay different because of these behavioral patterns that we can observe based on how people react to the content they're receiving based on what type of device they're watching it on. So I think it's really interesting when we think about platforms that have been considered traditional and how we, from a Nielsen perspective, measure consumption of that content in the future, and how much of that conversation needs to be centered around how that content is served, whether it is close enough to digital or new media-based content serving, so that everything is now sort of just one larger total content measurement solution, or if behaviors remain so inherently different that we're unable to reconcile the differences that come with watching something on a large screen in a room with probably a bunch of other people compared to watching something on a really small screen in a more intimate and private setting. I think print is, you know, even more interesting as it relates to what's actually out in the world printed on text compared to what is online. I think there's a lot less overlap in those industries than there is between TV and digital. Things that are printed in text, like paper newspapers, while they might have the same stories, their ads certainly can't be served in the same way digital ads are served, et cetera. So in that area, I think there certainly remains a difference between those mediums that will probably remain as long as people are interested in reading printed newspapers and magazines. But certainly in the space where content is served over the air or over, you know, a digital server, then there's going to be some interesting conversations about what is the same and what isn't the same as we move forward.
I think so. To add to that, I think the big place where there may be kind of a convergence between traditional forms of media and what's happening in digital is really larger scale out of home ads. So you can imagine, for example, really large billboards, so like billboards in Times Square, or you know, billboards along the interstate, or maybe even in certain cases, depending on how good. How precise your beacons are for capturing data, even ads within specific quasi-public spaces like airports or stadiums or something like that. So because now basically every single person, at least in the United States, that is over the age of like two, and most people on the planet that can afford it have a cell phone. And because of that, there are going to be ample places where, and this goes back to the whole privacy case and really understanding what's happening when you're carrying effectively a device that can capture and transmit lots and lots of information about you. Everywhere you go, you can now, not now, but in the future, you will be able to get rough estimates, directional estimates of exposure to certain out-of-home ads, okay, to a certain out-of-home campaign. So, for example, you might say, like, hey, this person, you know, they were driving along the interstate at this specific span of time. We know that this device was seen on the interstate in this area at this span of at this specific time. There was a gigantic ad for for Arby's. I love QSRs, so I basically eat fast food. But no, that's not true, but whatever. For the purposes of this conversation, it can be. And so the idea is, as you see this Arby's ad there, maybe there's an Arby's ad at an airport that, again, the same device was seen at, and you can now begin to say, like, hey, this specific device was exposed at least twice to this specific Arby's campaign. Maybe you layer in the digital perspective and say, hey, they actually also, this device was seen on the specific ad server's logs when that device was delivered, that specific campaign. And again, maybe they were co-located within a specific household that has a smart TV, and we know that that smart TV was on when a specific Arby's ad, again, was aired on some linear channel. So, I mean, I think more in the future that you will have this kind of convergence of out-of-home with digital advertising platforms in terms of being able to measure the effectiveness of out-of-home promos. But I mean, I think with that you're gonna have to kind of understand all of these privacy concerns that people have, all of these issues that we've talked about throughout this conversation. That anywhere where you can record information about people, it's going to be recorded, and there needs to be opt out. There need to be all of these privacy things in place. Newspapers, I think, though, I don't know, unless you like embed chips in them or something. I don't see newspapers in traditional print, like me reading The New Yorker and turning the page and there being a physical pixel firing and record. I don't know, that would be really creepy. The point is, I think print will remain kind of much more of a it'll be much harder to measure the effectiveness of print ads there.
Definitely. And something interesting we've sort of touched on is, so we've been talking a lot about the effectiveness of advertising and how to determine the effectiveness. There's a flip side to that, which is, how does this field of digital advertising change as people become more and more saturated with advertisements and they start to tune them out? What happens to this industry one day when people just say, I'm done, right? I remember years ago when banner ads were, I guess they're still kind of a hot thing, not so much anymore, but in the shortly after the early days of banner ads, people noticed that, yeah, your average person reading on the internet just knows to not look at certain parts of the page, which I think says a lot for that ad's effectiveness, because if it's displayed but the person effectively never sees it, what happens?
Yeah, so I'm not an advertiser, so I think that gives me a little bit more freedom in my candor about the future of the advertising industry. Thankfully, I just work in measurement, even on content measurement, not even on digital advertising measurement. So I think I can afford to be a little bit more critical here, in which I would say I think, unfortunately, the future of advertising in this space where people are oversaturated and are seeing too many ads that appear traditional is the rise of native advertising, is the rise of advertising that looks like content, or even more terrifying, the rise of, you know, articles that are completely created to meet an advertising threshold for certain sponsored clients. You know, I've heard of online sites that have, you know, certain advertising sponsors, and they have to work that company into articles they write on their site a certain number of times per month, or they have to write an article that is really an ad but looks enough like an article that people click on it and are reading it like it's the news, or, you know, in content online where ads are sort of worked into the actual entertainment of the show. That I'm actually more okay with if I'm just watching a show and there just happens to be some great product placement or conversation about a product. That seems a little bit less like all-encompassingly terrible for society than a news article that is really an advertisement but has written to look and feel like I'm reading the news. But unfortunately, I think that's where we're heading, is a lot more a lot of advertising that is just going to look and feel less like advertising. And to a certain degree, that can be helpful if it's really aptly well-placed and it really is truly useful. I could think of an example of, you know, certain types of medical treatments that are being advertised through this sort of native advertising on news sites, where that really is something that is useful to a person that would be reading an article that highlighted that type of medical treatment, and it would be helpful for them to find out that information. I just think there's going to be a lot more work on the advertiser's part to make sure, and those, you know, presenting that type of native advertising, to ensure that we're not doing anything harmful there, to make sure that there is some sort of moral and ethical lines that we're not willing to cross.
So I think this is where Lauren and I can respectfully disagree, because basically native ads have always existed, or at least they've existed while I've been alive. I mean, I haven't been alive for very long, but for example, E.T. and Reese's, right? Like, that was literally a thing that happened, and nobody died.
But that's different than a news article, right?
No, that's true. That's very, very true. But, I mean, I think the thing is, advertising is the reason that the internet basically exists, right? Like, without advertising, we wouldn't have the capabilities that we have in the internet. Like, it's basically what funds everything that we have. We wouldn't have a measurement industry if there was no advertising, and we wouldn't have any of the services that we have on the internet. That, like, we wouldn't have basically print media, we wouldn't have anything, because ultimately it's all about attention, right? If you can capture somebody's attention, that means that on the side, derivatively, you can also post something there. I do agree that there will definitely be, there's definitely going to be oversaturation of advertising everywhere, but that's always been the case, right? Like, as soon as you could build buildings tall enough, somebody was like, wait, I can just put an advertisement that's that tall and paste it on that building, you know? Like, so I think what'll happen is basically, like, the old media, so, like,
I almost think of like banner ads as like old media at this point, where it used to be back in like 1999 when you saw a banner ad, you're like, wait, that's kind of interesting. And then by 2001, you're like, oh God, don't ignore all of the borders on any web page that I ever see, because that's where all of the advertisements will be. I mean, you can imagine, so now people have done that, and now people tune out commercials, but what do? Now there's advertisements and content, like you have Reese's in E.T., or I remember watching an episode of High Maintenance, and the dude, because that's his name, he literally walks through a Casper store. It was the craziest. I was just like, what is happening? Why is this? Why did this turn into? And that'll happen. Or, for example, you can imagine when we all start wearing augmented reality glasses that basically every surface will be carpeted with ads, right? Because you're going to be wearing those glasses, or maybe there'll be a cyborg imprint, and it'll be a chip embedded in your brain, and as you're walking, you'll just see random ads on different surfaces. I mean, I think the thing is, I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing, because people are inherently very, very adaptable, and they will either completely tune them out, or they will pay. I mean, there's also the option, right? Like, we have that option now with lots of services where you can pay for ad-free experiences, right? It becomes like an issue of economics. You can pay, whatever, $10 a month to watch. I mean, I think the most famous service now that does this is Hulu. You can either pay $10 a month for limited ads on Hulu, or $15, I don't know how much it is, for completely ad-free experiences. I mean, I think that that's just going to be the way where that goes. And in cases where you don't have that option, you're just going to tune everything out like you usually do, other than the stuff that actually matters.
So I can understand being okay. I'm not personally okay with it, but I can understand morally in society being okay with seeing branded ad in content, in shows that you're watching. But do you feel the same way about news articles?
Oh, absolutely not. No, absolutely not. There I can definitely agree with you. I mean, yeah, I don't want somebody to be like, hey, 10 ways to fight climate change, and then number one is, you know, buy this specific brand's toilet paper. Or I agree that would be ridiculous. Or it'd be like, oh, hey, you know, this really important thing happened. Oh, and by the way, that person was drinking Coke. Like, you know.
Yeah. That's what I think we're starting to see more of, which is concerning.
Yeah.
Right? And to a certain extent, people who are creating content, you know, shows for TV or other digital platforms, they have to balance this, like, how much native advertising do we put on our show before people are like, this is ridiculous, I'm not going to watch these, like, back-to-back ads, essentially, with some action linking them together.
Yeah.
But in news articles, just especially in our current environment about how we as a country are thinking about the news, that seems to me like something that should be off limits, and it's surprising that it isn't. That we're so okay with that, you know, something can be essentially the content native advertising, but text version, which is, I think, crossing a line.
Yeah, I could see that. Cool. Well, tell you what, we are getting very close to running out of time, unfortunately, as much as I'd love to keep this conversation going. So to wrap up, maybe we can just take a couple of minutes to think about the state of the digital industry and ask ourselves, what changes would we like to see in the future? Who would like to go first?
I would be glad to have some final thoughts on this. I mean, I think still ultimately, really, it's about giving consumers the choice and transparency around what's being collected in a way that isn't just wrapped in a bunch of legalese. I think that the entire industry has to come together on some set of standards around how that's done and what the appropriate level of granularity around that understanding how digital collection practices are happening, and the opportunities for people to systematically be able to opt out of said tracking. I think that has to happen in the future. And I think that there are forward-thinking states like California that are leading the charge, that are making this be a
a thing that people are going to be talking about for the foreseeable future. We'll see if we get anywhere, but I think that that's going to be really, really important. So again, transparency about what's being collected, and also so showing actual consumers, this is what we know about you at this level of granularity. And that actually it plays really two roles. One is you're being honest with the consumer, but it also allows the consumer to correct the record for themselves. So you can imagine that lady who kept being who said that she downloaded her Facebook logs and saw that all of these car advertisers had been trying to reach her with car ads. Could have been like, hey guys, I'm actually not in market for a car. I'm actually in market for a dog, or I'm in market for a new piece of furniture or something else. So that consumers can actually correct that and actually be delivered ads that are good for them, in the sense that it actually helps them understand that this thing is available or this specific thing is on sale. Without also at the same time being like super, super creepy. The other side is just being very, very transparent about what you are actually collecting, and having, I really think, this like modifiable terms of service, I think, is something that would be that would be really, really great if every single app or web experience actually had several different levels of terms of service acceptability. Terms of service acceptability, such that you could say, hey, I'm not okay with this and this, but as a result, I'm sacrificing this specific functionality in your product, but I am okay with this, so I want this lower level amount of functionality in your product. I think that would be very fair.
Cool. All right. Thank you, Sergi. And you, Lauren, what are your thoughts?
So from a measurement perspective, I think we're at an interesting sort of culmination point. I agree with the points around privacy and figuring out how do we move the industry towards a space where consumers are comfortable with the information that's being collected about them and are aware of the information that's being collected about them and how it's being used. You know, we've talked about that awareness as it relates to those in, say, a panel or first-party data, but extending that awareness to those who have their data in third-party data sets or big data sets, and marrying that concept with continuing to move the measurement industry forward and to work in really unique and different spaces. So as we start to build new solutions to understand how behavior is happening on over-the-top devices. You know, Nielsen has started work on that. And, you know, as we continue to move down the path of really understanding out-of-home and all of these new addressable ads, how we measure those and understand what's happening there, we have a lot of new areas in the industry that we need to provide data science solutions for. And since we have started to have these privacy and ethical conversations already, I think this is really good training ground to figure out how we can combine those concepts, how we can build those solutions from the ground up and start with the ethics and privacy in mind, and to make sure that we're building products that we want to last in the industry and are comfortable with the framework we're putting around them in the industry, since we do have so many new concepts coming down the pipeline that affect the media and entertainment industry. I'm hopeful that we can combine those concepts in the areas where it makes sense as a trial ground first.
I really like that, and I think that is, first of all, a very hopeful note on which to end, really great note on which to end. Like, thank you both for joining us here today. Again, I am Kim McCallum, Senior Content Advisor here at Formulated By, and I've been speaking with...
I'm Lauren Lombardo, Senior Data Scientist at Nielsen.
And...
Sergi Fogelson, Vice President of Data Science at Viacom.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.